Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hi, I'm Katie Evans, AHDB's Grass, Forage and Soil Specialist. And welcome to this episode where we explore the idea of improving your farm's ecosystem while maintaining productivity. It's more easily said than done, I know, which is why my guest is Jason Rowntree, Professor of Animal Science at Michigan State University and Director of MSU Center of Regenerative Agriculture. He's a real expert in this field. Jason was our guest speaker at our AHDB Beef and Lamb Knowledge Exchange Program, Roots to Resilience. As part of the first module, we ran a series of events and gave it the grand title of Change the Goal, Change the System, Balancing Food Production and Ecosystem. Easy for me to say. There is more information and content on our website, but as for our chat, I began with asking Jason to tell me how he adopted new ways of thinking.
Before I came to Michigan State, I was in Louisiana. Was just doing regular things. So Wendell Berry is this amazing author in the U.S., right? And he writes about agriculture. He says all land-grant universities are like airports. Once you've been to one, you've been to them all. Nice. And we tend to do all this research that's very similar, you know, across institution. And I was sitting there and started to read more about these renegade ranchers, right, that are super low input. There's a gentleman by the name of Kit Farrow that really caught my eye probably about 2006. And so I got an opportunity to come back to Michigan State. We've got a farm. It's called Lake City Research Center. I manage that. And I also work, we have a site up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is like right kind of by like nestled in between Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. We get like 400, like over 4 meters of snow. It's crazy. But I oversee those sites, right? And so I had that opportunity to come back, say, okay, here are some bigger scale properties.
Yeah.
That is an opportunity to say, what does this low input system look like? That's what we were calling it back then, was this low input beef, you know? And so this is, goodness, you know, that thought process was almost 20 years ago. So I got to the farm, right, in Lake City, and I basically stopped everything that we'd been doing for 20 years. We had world-class scientists have been working at this site. This site was one of the very first sites that actually we brought in European genetics into the United States, like in the 70s and early 80s. So this is where some of the original Fleck V cattle came into this site, others, right? And at that time, we had some really super moderate Hereford cows. This is in the 70s and 80s, right? And so this is where some of the very first crossbreeding research in the U.S. took place. So there's history there, right? And so once we got these nice F1 cows that were kind of Simmental Hereford, then we started breeding to say, hey, do EPDs work or not, right? So we were breeding to high milk, high yearling weight Angus bulls. This is in the 90s now. And then the next scientist after a while just started crisscross mating to high growth, high milk Angus and Simmental. So what I want to say is that when I got to this site, I'm ready to do this low input deal, right? And my cows were like 1,800 pounds. They're like 800 plus kilos. So I needed a new cow herd because I didn't want to spend the rest of my career trying to get those back down. And then simultaneously, what we did from a forage management perspective, right, is that we grazed May to August, May to September, put up a lot of hay. We're probably hitting each acre with 50 to 100 units of N. What I want to say, it was a very input-driven grazing system. And so I showed up, and I'm going to save the world, right? So I just, like, stop all that. Thank the Lord our manager was okay.
I was going to say, you didn't make a lot of friends.
Oh, my goodness. I was so worried about being told no. I just said, you know what? I'm not going to ask for permission. I'm going to beg for forgiveness. Probably one of the worst career mistakes I've ever made because I got my ass chewed on by more people. What it was is I was afraid to be told no. And what happened is word gets out, but it's not like the real word. Yeah. And so, my goodness, our State Cattlemen's Association is asking all these questions. And I've got other people. There's a rumor that what I did is I sold all my cows.
Yeah.
And I went into 5L Red Angus, and they're in Sheridan, Montana, the largest seed stock registered Red Angus cattle in the nation, in the U.S. And I bought 10% of their cow herd out. And so I basically, those cows are going to be probably 500 kilo, somewhere in there, right? But I didn't ask anybody. I just pulled the trigger on these things. And rumors abound, right? Like I brought in belt buckle high cattle, and and we had like, I mean, we had all kinds of interesting dynamics. I had hate letters written to the president of the university.
Oh my God.
And it's because I was being stupid, right? I was younger. I was in my 30s, and I just didn't. And so I just plowed ahead. And I think at the end of the day, I got it done. And so what we did is I brought in a new set of cows. Number one. Number two, I quit fertilizing. I haven't fertilized this site now in over 15 years. I have played with a little fertilizer when I'm interseeding annuals, like to look at some mixtures with brassicas and cowpeas and whatnot. Really emphasize diversity. The other thing I did is that we had to run a lot of interior fencing and water. And basically what we wanted to do is we wanted to set up an intensive rotational grazing system. Did all that, right? And so I did it pretty much in a year. I read Holistic Management by Alan Savory. It was a huge driver in my thinking. I discovered Alan's work in 2009.
So I was going to say, there was something driving you.
Yeah.
There was something that you had a target, you had a vision, you had something that you were working towards. What was that? What was the big push?
Okay. And that Alan's work really helped elucidate that for me. And here's the deal is like, I sat there as an academic, really frustrated with a discipline-driven model so back in Louisiana, we ran what's called the Master Cattle Producers Program. And it was written to like be a freshman level class for introductory ranchers to take, okay, the best on animal breeding, genetics, repro, forage management, grazing management, blah, 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 right? And so we put this beautiful notebook together and all this wonderful info, and it was the perfect recipe to bankrupt somebody. And the reason I say that is that, okay, well, how do you maximize forages? How do you maximize weaning weight? You know, how do you maximize this and that and outputs, right? It never once looked at it as a system, an integrated system. And I would sit there thinking about, okay, well, I can plant a new variety of coastal Bermuda grass or some kind of Bermuda grass, and it might grow 10 tons to the acre or 10 metric tons to the hectare. But it also requires 300 units of N. And I've got to put something that's not natural into something that, you know, I've got to seed, I've got to do all that, right? And then for a couple of years, it's like we can get all this yield if the weather cooperates. But then we're back to where we were, right? So all those things, they weren't fitting in my head because I didn't realize it, but I was a very systems thinker. Yeah. And thinking about the complexity and the integration of all these things. And that's where the concepts of thinking about more holistic approaches to management really took root. So that would have been, like early to mid 2000s. And I've just... thankfully, it's freeing to understand that it was okay to think differently.
Yeah.
Academics are discipline driven, right? And so that's kind of where it changed for me.
How did you bring people along on that journey? And how did you challenge their paradigms? Because all those people contacting you, sending letters, they had questions of, and I imagine a lot of them are, what are you doing and why? How do you bring them and convince them that this is the right journey that you're going on for your system and for where your farm's located?
Great. Yeah, well, first of all, I'm very thankful that there are a subset of farmers that were thinking differently. And they are applauding me, right? And often not applauding me, but were supportive, right? And thankfully also, amazingly, a former president, national president of the National Cattlemen's and Beef Association, a gentleman by the name of Gary Volt, was on our advisory group for Lake City. And after he bailed me out of trouble a few times with the state cattle industry, he was able to help be a better translator. Yeah. But even further, he kind of became more of a mentor in saying, okay, well, we need to think about how you frame things and how you work forward. Because my job, the last thing I want to be is antagonistic. Mm-hmm. The last thing a farmer wants to hear is a wrong. And so there has to be this kind of shared conversation about what we're after. And, you know, what we care about, right, are improvements in profitability, in ecosystem function, and quality of life, mm-hmm. not only in the short term, but in the long term. And that's what thinking holistically and what holistic management and other things have done for me, because it forces us to push past that short-term decision. What I would also like to say is I am not aware of many farm policies, whether it be over here in the U.S., that frames long-term strategies. Mm-hmm. It's always about next year. It's always about the next crop. It's always about the next farm bill. So how can we expect farmers and ranchers to be thinking long-term when everything we do politically and with industry is typically on a very short-term basis? So I work with a lot of really awesome ranchers in the U.S., one of which is a gentleman by the name of Will Harris at White Oak Pastures. He just has written a great book. I'm going to talk about research that I've done on their farm. Yeah. But the thing is that what drives him as an outlier, perhaps, but he is so 100% committed to the health and the livelihood of the land and the livestock that he looks at his grandchildren and say, what does this farm need to look like for this their grandchildren? Because this farm is a five-generation farm, and I know there's many in England that are as well, and if not further, right? And I see those drivers about, you know, what are we leaving future generations? Mm-hmm. And that to me has been a real driver in a lot of the farms and ranches I know that are thinking about these things in what I would call like a more regenerative way.
It's something, again, we touched on that Roots to Resilience workshop with Dallas, was how we look at farms being sustainable. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's not just about the environment side of it, but sustainable in the sense for the family. And is it an asset that you are passing on to the next generation? Yeah.
So here's the deal, right? Like, If we were to truly monetize ecological function, mm-hmm. what is a huge improvement in water infiltration on a landscape worth? Like, it, when you talk about challenges with phosphorus, when you talk about challenges with water quantity, you know, we see these aspects now where we have fairly consistent amounts of moisture, mm-hmm. but they come in more intense windows, right? Are y'all seeing, do you begin to see those things here? I don't know.
Definitely. Or excess rainfall over the winter periods.
Yeah.
And then come April,
long,
May.
Long, dry. Yeah.
We start seeing some of those drought effects.
So it ain't the rain you get, it's the rain you keep. Yeah. And the driver then is that, but what is that worth, right? Like, if we can strengthen and boost the improvements in soil to harbor more moisture, mm-hmm. what is that worth? What is it worth to, like, and dramatically improve biodiversity mm-hmm. on a farmscape? What is it worth to improve carbon? Okay. What is it worth to improve food resiliency? But today, in today's agriculture system, we pretty much still think about monetizing an output over an input. Yeah. And that's what farmers have to do. They have to play the game to get paid, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what you'll find, and when you talked about value,
yeah.
is that if we emphasize the broader picture, that those landscapes are worth so, so much more with improved ecosystem function. And that, to me, is the long-term future. That's the payday. How it gets there, I wish I could say better. But to me, if we truly value our future, then those aspects should be rewarded, that farmers that are managing that way should be greater rewarded. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is how I see this moving forward.
So you mentioned there ecosystem functionality within agricultural systems. But for the benefit of
some... said it that smart, but yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, all right. Okay.
We'll go with that. That's what I heard.
You're sounding smart. Yeah, I got it. All right.
For the benefit of some of our listeners, can you explain what the principles of ecological agriculture are that ecosystem?
Okay, so I think of the soil health principles, first of all, right? Like, so when we talk about regenerative ag, and how do you define regenerative ag? Well, before you can say grace, there's 50 definitions. And I don't really give a damn about any of them. I want to be led by principle and driven to outcome, quantifiable outcome, not check the boxes, but outcomes. So what are those? Well, we know that they are keeping your ground covered. Mm-hmm. That having bare ground does not mimic nature. It doesn't mimic things that we do naturally at all. And I'm coming from an area where we see a lot of bare ground, right? But every time a rain drop hits bare ground, it's creating compaction and it's moving a nutrient perhaps off the farm, right? Mm-hmm. So that's it, keeping your ground covered. Having greater perennialization, even in annual systems, but greater perenniality in those systems, i.e. how long throughout the year can I have living roots in my soils here? Yeah. And I drive around here and I'm like, y'all, I mean, we have a killing frost in September and our soil temps don't get warm enough till mid-May.
Yeah.
And I see the opportunities here and I'm like, man, it's awesome, right? Because you have a much greater window of growth mm-hmm. opportunity, right? So living roots, okay? Improving and enhancing biodiversity above and below ground.
Yeah.
Big critters, small critters, microbiological type of diversity, improving invertebrates, vertebrates, trophic cascades, right? So thinking about biodiversity is another one. Getting grazing livestock back in cropping systems, mm-hmm. y'all do a much better job of that than we do. And minimizing disturbance, whether it be through tillage. Notice I don't say get rid, I say minimize. And I think I hit them all, but most importantly is context. It's that social deal, right? So what I want to say then is that anybody can begin to move along a gradient mm-hmm. of adopting principles that will lead to greater ecological outcome. It isn't you are or you ain't, all right? It isn't this like binary thing. And yet we tend to make it binary. Are you regenerative or not, Katie? Mm-hmm. You know, and that just mm-hmm. creates strife. It creates malcontent. Yeah. And so any farmer anywhere can improve. And so that's the way I think about it. So I've spent my career, again, shoulder to shoulder, working with really amazing farmers that are thinking out of the box. But how do we quantify those outcomes? Mm. And then finally, how do we pay farmers for those outcomes?
That's Jason Rowntree, Professor of Animal Science at Michigan State University. Jason's been helping AHDB with our Roots to Resilience program, talking about the aspirations of improving ecosystems while maintaining productivity on our farms. I'm Katie Evans, and as part of this food and farming podcast, I pretty much asked him to spell out how can we achieve this particular goal on farm.
First of all, profit equals income minus expense. Most of the data from the U.S. would suggest that 90% of the greater indicators of profitability are on the expense side and not the income side. Right. What do we like to do? We like to get more per pound. We like to have more pounds. We like to have more bushels. But at the end of the day, typically cost is the greater driver of profitability. Mm-hmm. So back to our farm, right? We've actually increased productivity considerably on our site. And I've done it by less nitrogen, right? I've gotten rid of it, right? And so that's a huge drop in our expenses. Guess what? I'm not out there haying all the time. I do buy hay.
Yeah.
I buy hay onto my farm because if I could graze year round, I would, but I can't. Honestly, what we do find as well is by moderating our cow herd, they become considerably more energetically efficient. Mm-hmm. Effectively, what we find is the smaller and more moderate our cows are, we see them weaning a greater percentage of their own body weight. So let's say then that 450 kilo cow is more apt to wean a 225 kilo calf.
Yeah.
And so all these things combined is we actually begin to see more marketable pounds mm-hmm. per unit land than we do in a higher growth model, which sees more sellable pounds per calf. But if you put it on a land basis, you actually have more marketable pounds because you have more calves with a lighter, more moderate cow. So all those things combined, we see huge decreases in cost because a more moderate cow can graze longer in the season. She needs less. Mm-hmm. And she more adequately converts that forage into a marketable calf than what a bigger cow does by weight per land.
And I suppose even on farm, from a footprint point of view, from your carbon audit side, we won't get into it right now. But again, there's those benefits, isn't there, from having that smaller cattle on farm.
Yeah.
And the way that they're grazing, the way you're able to manage them, when you're looking at those offsets, there's some really...
Can we get sciencey for a minute, Katie?
Okay.
A little bit sciencey. A little data. So there's a number called YM in the IPCC methane equation.
Right.
YM, it's the energy loss from the rumen that is converted to methane. Mm-hmm. We know methane is, you know, it's a very natural thing. I don't want to go down that road yet. But what I'd like to say is that the standard number that we're supposed to use for the IPCC equations is around 6.5%, which means that a normal standard cow loses 6.5% of the energy in her rumen to methane.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we've done multiple trials and normally find that number to be around 4.8 to 4.9%, which is, what is that, a 25%, 30% reduction? That alone is a huge savings on a carbon calculation. But unfortunately, the IPCC doesn't talk to my cows, and the cows don't read the IPCC, right? So we do see a marked reduction in energy loss to methane with a more moderate cow that is just really good at converting forage to back fat and to calves. So we do see improvements there for sure.
And I suppose there's other halves to those, or other parts to those conversations. Methane is one parameter that is being measured. Mm-hmm. But when we're looking at it compared then to carbon, what's being able to be stored or sort of sequestered into our soils, what's the relationship or the correlation between, and I know we're getting into it now, but when we're talking about that livestock, that animal that you're speaking of, that particular waste, how does this all marry up in the sense of what that cow's emitting in emissions of methane, what your management system from a carbon point of view sequestering?
Does it all add up?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Or does it?
Number one, it's context, right? Mm-hmm. It's context of the farm. So going back on this question you're asking, right? Methane and how that impacts the overall carbon footprint is very contextual. Mm. What do we like to do? Not me, but what does, you know, my friends down at Oxford and some other places, what do they like to do? They like to take every damn place on the planet and then take the mean of it and perpetuate that as the norm, okay? Yeah. I know there's good people at Oxford too, so sorry down there in Oxford. But these global means mean nothing at a localized ranch site. Every site's different. What I can tell you, though, is that the more intensively you're stocked, the harder you're pushing intensity, you have to obviously sequester considerably more carbon to see these things break even. Mm-hmm. Such that for us, if you're in a system where I'm stocked at, let's say, 500 kilo cow and calf on a hectare, I'm probably going to need about 0.6, 0.7 metric tons of carbon per hectare annually to see that break even. If I am stocked with one cow-calf pair in a more rugged environment like I might see in Oklahoma, let's say I've got one cow-calf pair on 5 hectares, then that number drops to like 0.2, 0.3, right? So every system's different. Does that make sense, right? Yeah. And so I don't want to make these broad strokes about that, nor am I saying you're forcing me to do so. But what I want to say is every site's different, okay? So we have seen, and I have measured multiple sites that are able to offset that. We see a lot of sites that aren't. Mm-hmm. So the relationships are, to me, important. And the one that we're leaving out is nitrous oxide. If I look at global warming potentials, which means the heat trapping ability of a molecule, and we use CO2 as a baseline, Methane is going to run, based on what number you use, 25 to 30 more times heat trapping than CO2. Nitrous is 300. Mm-hmm. So nitrous is considerably greater than methane.
Yeah.
And 300 times more than CO2. So basically what the math says is that if you're using nitrogen, you're not going to offset your footprint. Mm-hmm. It's just damn near impossible. If you take nitrogen out of the equation, then I think there are definitely opportunities where we see, and at minimum, we can drop the footprint considerably, right? It doesn't necessarily have to break even. Everybody gets all on this carbon negative deal, and I try to stay away from that because it just picks fights on Twitter and stuff. But the point is that even then, like, it, there are great opportunities of lowering these footprints well past 30%, which is what many of the beef folks have used as a target.
Yeah.
So it's complex. I honestly think that in many of the systems I see that nitrous is a bigger driver than methane, and that soil carbon is the most important. But we typically don't even use soil carbon in the equation.
When we're talking about the nitrous oxide side of things, do you just want to touch on, from a fertilizer point of view or a nitrogen point of view, when you're applying that into land? And it's something that we've spoken about before, and I thought it was really interesting because it is something our farmers are facing more regularly now, is drought, and actually the requirement and how that fits in with water recycling and that moisture aspect of it. And is that something that you can sort of like just expand on a little bit of the nitrous oxide and how that ties in?
You know, obviously there are different levels of nitrogen use and nitrogen volatilization, right? And we do know that there are more and improved methodologies of applying nitrogen that tend to see considerably less volatilization. We can see nitrogen going up a couple different ways. It can go up and it can go down. Work from Michigan State from my colleague Bruno Basso, looking at yield stability mapping, would suggest in a cropland system in the U.S., in the upper Midwest, we can lose as much as 30% of our N through leaching because the soil is just not stable enough to hold it.
Right.
I don't know what the math would look like here, but the point is I don't think it would be a lot different. Mm-hmm. That we tend to lose considerable nitrogen just based on the fact that the land isn't stable enough to use it.
Yeah.
And so that's one point, right, is that the yield stability of the land is important. Number two, you know, we can apply in a more volatile form, and then we don't get a proper rain event, a timely rain event, and we can lose a lot of it. Mm-hmm. We can put it out and get a huge rain event and see volatilization, blah, blah, blah. Why don't we simplify? And what we've done is that we've replaced simple mixtures in our forages with complex mixtures. So I may have trefoil, red clover, white clover, others in a field, different forbs like a chicory or some things like that, and alfalfa with it, and then I might have four or five tall cool season grasses. I can only grow warm season annuals. Point I want to make is that the diversity piece is huge. We're more of an alfalfa grass kind of an approach.
Yeah.
And we'll compare that to a really robust, diverse system. And if you're to look at that over a 5-year window, up front, you'll probably see more productivity with the alfalfa grass. Mm-hmm. I have a hell of a lot more cost too. And then over time, after about year three, things mm-hmm. start to change, and that more diverse sward becomes more competitive. And then from there on, you typically see the diverse sward more competitive in terms of yield productivity. But what I want to say is that nature wants to go to something more complex. Mm-hmm. There isn't monocultures in nature. There's very few two plant systems in nature. It wants to go to something that's natural. So what do we do? And this is something I struggle with in Louisiana, is that we're going to find the newest, sexiest hybrid Bermuda grass, and we're going to work the ground, and we can't seed it. So we've actually got to, you know, put in like root systems and mm-hmm. we've got to kind of plug it that way and spend a lot of money to get this 10 ton to the acre.
Yeah.
And after 5 years, The same grass that wanted to be there 5 years ago is starting to outcompete again. So I have all that cost there. We see just safer, more productive environments the more biodiverse we are. If we're in areas that we think might need more legumes, we no-till them in, and we frost seed. Yeah. So I can broadcast legumes 3 to 5 kilos per hectare. It can be a diverse, it can be a lot of different legumes. And that's kind of how we keep nitrogen up in our system. We tend to, for our finishers, you know, we tend to want to shoot for, if we can get like a 60-40 grass to legume type of mixture, that's great. Typically, they'll probably fall down and they'll probably want to maintain more in a 20-30% range over time. Long story there, but I think that for us, I think we see better and higher quality nitrogen function with the diversity versus simple grasses and added nitrogen.
What are some of the challenges and opportunities do you believe the industry is facing in balancing productivity and environmental sustainability?
Great question. Supply chains, I work with many supply chains. I'd say 98% of all the funding I receive is through philanthropic or federal grant dollars typically. So I've done some work with supply chains. Point I want to say is I don't really take much of their money really. And I know that can be a issue of conflict with some folks. But I work with them and I need to. That's my job, is to work with the meat industry. I'm happy to work with them. Good colleagues. But I don't know of many that haven't made pledges to reduce their emissions. Yeah. These companies are publicly owned. They're publicly traded. They have shareholders. They have boards. And there is a commitment to drop and to lower. And so beef industry, sheep industry, you're either at the table or you're on the menu. You need to make the decision. And where we are today is that we are going to have to see more accounting in the system. That doesn't mean what we're doing is wrong necessarily, right? Like I want to make sure that that's the point. The point is that we're going to have to measure it a lot better. And therefore, knowing what we know about improving ecosystem function and the opportunities to improve land, there is a great opportunity for our farmers and ranchers. They're standing on a huge solution. And I think that's the thing to focus on. And in doing so, it can be through a reduced emission intensity per kilo of product. It can be through improving ecosystem function per unit product. And it's happening, whether we like it or not. And we have these things right now, for instance, like SBTI, which is, you know, the Scientifically Based Target Initiatives, which is a conglomerate of NGOs that are looking at accounting processes and life cycle assessment processes for supply chains to work to identify where their footprints are, where they need to reduce them. And that's not going away. I see more and more of it. I don't necessarily agree with the methodology. I'll be clear in that. And so where is this bigger picture going? Okay. Recently, the FAIRR, which is a global NGO, has done some significant polling on, you know, what these things, you know, what are companies doing today? I'm going to actually get the real data up so I don't screw up here. And so of the 79 they surveyed, 50 of them had mentioned regenerative agriculture initiatives in their disclosures. 50 of those 79. These companies were worth over $3 trillion. Of those 50, most all of them are thinking about soil health and carbon. Yeah. Of the 50, 18 have actually quantified company-wide targets for regenerative ag. Okay, so that's like 36%. 16% or 8 of those 50 have discussed metrics and data. Only 4 companies having actually established baselines.
Yeah.
And then finally, of those 50, only 4 have really reached out to financially support farmers. So we could look at that a hell of a lot of different ways. But number one, it's on companies' radars. Yeah. Number two, you could say, oh, well, companies are talking about it and they're not paying for it. But I think really at the end of the day is they don't know how to move forward.
Yeah.
That there's this like, well, we know we need to do something. Mm-hmm. We just don't know how to get there yet. And so now where's the opportunity? Well, you've only got 4 of the 50 that are actually thinking about monetizing. Well, we need 50 of 50 and we need the 79 of 79. We work hand in hand with policy, I think, to get there. And so then what that does is it creates, and I think one of the biggest log jams in all of this is we don't speak consistent language mm-hmm. from the farmer all the way to the supply chain, all the way to the consumer. Mm-hmm. So we've got to tear down the Tower of Babel.
Yep.
And we've got to move forward in a way that we're all speaking the same language. And so to me, the writing's on the wall. How do we choose to respond? I would much rather see the industries I work with being proactive to say, these are what our emissions are, this is what we're doing, versus having third-party auditors that wear penny loafers to work every day that are telling us how we should farm and ranch. And I think that's going to be a bad deal at the end of the day. No offense, I don't own penny loafers, but I have friends that do. Point being is that it's coming, Katie. Yeah. How we respond is what's most important.
You touched there on the baselining side. That is so important. It's the first step in a lot of this.
Yep.
How in the US, how does that work? Are you baselining across
the industry? It's a
wild
west.
Or is it?
No. Yeah. So to me, Australia's got the best route forward right now.
That's one that we look to as well when we're comparing where we are and where we want to be.
Perfect, yeah. How in the hell the Aussies got ahead, I don't know. No offense, I got friends there, it's a joke. But the fact is that what has to happen, right, is we just have to create a baseline that the easier part in Australia is not many of these guys are using nitrogen at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're much more expansive. But what they're doing is they basically working with CSIRO and others, they have a baseline per ranch that gives them an emission. It's where they live, like the geography, it's the productivity, it's the amount of livestock they have. And they can create a baseline. And then they basically then can choose different opportunities of how to measure carbon. You can go 100% hardcore sampling. You can use a combination of modeling and sampling or a combination or just modeling alone. Mm-hmm. And then there are credits issued, ACCUs, A-C-C-U, that can potentially monetize a farm or ranch if they sequester above and beyond what's considered to be a baseline over time. Mm-hmm. So in the Australia system, it's the emission plus a time zero and a time one carbon that's 5 years apart.
Right.
There are still challenges in that system today. I was able to tour through 3 of the ranches that were the very first ranches to receive payments, working with a group called Carbon Link out of Australia last year. And these ranchers are doing great things. They're highly managed. You know, these systems that went from 10,000 hectares and 4 pastures to 10,000 hectares and 80 to 100 pastures, right? And so there's expense involved there, but the point is that they're able to highly manage their systems now. And so how does that work here? How does it work in the US? I don't think it's awfully different. We have really good science that shows what the baselines for a grazing feed yard or a grazing grass finishing system are. We use those as our baselines. We can tinker with them based on climate, based on rain, based on productivity. Mm-hmm. And then basically what we do is we work to understand what's happening with the footprint. I want to be clear to your listeners is that this isn't just about carbon.
Yeah.
It needs to be about water. It needs to be about biodiversity. It needs to be about other things. Unfortunately, carbon is the name of the game. But what we need to then provide is whatever this baseline looks like, we have different opportunities. It can be, in my opinion, and it should be, if a corporation needs to reduce their footprint by 30%, and they're making a pledge. Well, they've got to quantify what that pledge looks like. So let's say that a farmer maybe isn't carbon neutral or maybe isn't doing all the things that you know, all us academics aspire to. But let's say they're able to reduce their nitrogen by 80%.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? That's a huge number. And if they are able to do that, we need to quantify that and show that in the supply chain that this is a path forward for them. We know that there's potential to lose productivity. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a way of monetizing that gap. Yeah. So that's an opportunity. The other opportunities are, hey, what's happening again with carbon? I know most a lot of academics and others try to say that, there's no way we can offset the footprint much. I don't agree. I think that we need better monitoring. We need better metrics. Big grant I'd like to talk about later, perhaps we can talk about. But that aspect of building carbon is one. But then there's these ESG type of things, right, that are out there. And ESG is typically a bad word for a lot of folks in ag. But what I want to say is that, what about biodiversity? Mm. What about these aspects of improving the biodiversity through plants, through animals, through pollinator improvement, these things? To me, they're equally important. In fact, biodiversity is probably more important. I mean, that drives so much of what we're doing. So what I would like to say is that, in my mind, that there is a gradient of principles out there that producers can adopt. Mm-hmm. And based on certain baselines for carbon and other things, we can create financial standards. What I would also like to say is that, for me, is that I would rather see the attached improvement to a kilogram of what's being produced, whether it be a bushel of wheat or a kilo of beef or lamb or a bale of wool or a liter of milk, that to me, the most streamlined and easy way to do that is to attach it to what's actually being produced. Yeah. Because guess what? Now we have an output, an input, and a unit of ecosystem enhanced. So we have a three-way fraction versus a two-way fraction. What I see happening is we still keep the commodity a commodity, but now we're going to commoditize carbon also. And we're going to come in and we're going to help you do all this stuff. And we're going to measure, but we're going to charge you. We're going to do all these things. And what I fear, and no offense, it may evolve that way, and if it is, it does. What I fear is that it's going to screw the farmer again, meaning that there's going to be wealth taking out of that rural community and somebody else is putting it in their pocket when more of it could come back to the farm.
I'm Katie Evans, AHDB's grass forage and soil specialist, and you're listening to my interview with Professor Jason Rowntree. So far, our guest from Michigan State University has talked about how he first adopted ecological principles on his farm and how we can all look to improve our farm ecosystems while maintaining output. Jason's told me he's currently working on a number of projects, and his latest one was dreamt up during the pandemic when he, like a lot of us, found himself with a lot more time on his hands behind a screen of lots of Zoom calls.
So I sat there and I worked with a few people, and I'm like, okay, if we were going to create like the largest grazing metrics and monitoring project we could, what would it look like? And how much would it cost? And so I worked with a group primarily called the Noble Research Institute, which is in Ardmore, Oklahoma. They are the largest, they're a nonprofit, but they're the largest private research institute in the U.S. for agriculture. Mm-hmm. Worked with them. I worked with some other foundations. And then a group, what we call the Foundation for the Future of Ag Research. Mm-hmm. And we created a funded $19.2 million U.S. dollar grant to answer that question. Okay, we have the question meaning, you know, what metrics matter? How does management influence ecosystem function? What are the socioeconomic components of it? So we've got a 12-module project over 5 years. We are in Michigan, the upper Midwest. We work closely with our project, another project lead in Colorado State, Dr. Francesca Catrufo, I believe is the best soil biology and soil organic matter scientist globally. She's Italian, actually. She's at CSU with her and University of Wyoming. Mm-hmm. So we have that Western arid range environment. And then we have Oklahoma, Texas. So we work with Noble Research Institute primarily, and then also Texas A&M, guy by the name of Dr. Jeff Goodwin we work a lot with. So effectively, the first thing we did is we established three intensive sites at our research areas. So I've got a site, Oklahoma, Ardmore has a site where Noble is research. They've got about 15,000 acres of range and some improved C4 warm season grasses. And then we're on the McGuire Ranch at University of Wyoming, which is a very low rainfall, high elevation arid ranch. And we have basically thrown everything at these sites. So our treatments are what we call number one, adaptive, and number two, prescriptive, mm-hmm. which prescriptive means different things by geography. But it basically is I'm moving the cattle rhythmically and I'm doing everything in a very prescriptive way. Yeah. So for instance, at my site in Michigan, I bring the cattle into the site every 30 days. Now there may not be a hell of a lot to eat and I may take them out the next day, or there may be a lot to eat and I might leave them in there for a month. But I does that make sense? So every 30 days, where in my adaptive site, I'm trying to adapt and really improve the land. So I'm basically doing different things all the time. So it helps me be completely confounded, and mm-hmm. which scientists hate all that, but I love it. And so what we can do then is we might come in with a ton of density. So I might hit these areas. These treatments are about, they're about 5 hectares. Okay. Yeah. So I've got an adaptive abutting a prescriptive, and I might come in and hit it with, 500,000 kilos per hectare of density. Right. So,
okay.
Yeah, a lot, right? And or it may be late in the season, I might just go in and let the cows have a nibble and get out of there. But I'm measuring, there's nothing stable to it
right.
other than my brain.
Okay.
And we have a collective decision-making tool. Now, most people would raise Cain, right? Because it isn't replicated and you've got time and space confounding. But show me a farm that isn't confounded in time and space. Because every decision we make is based on a rain event or a time event. Yeah. There's nothing consistent. But yet in research, we tend to keep it all pretty and neat and clean. So I'm really getting serious now. What we do then is that we are measuring. I've got eddy covariate flux towers on all sites. So we've got these replicated sites in Oklahoma, Wyoming, and I say replicated. I've got like an N=3. I've got 3 pairs.
Yeah.
In Michigan, we might have, I think, 12 pairs in Oklahoma and 10 pairs in Wyoming. And all I'm doing is I'm measuring.
So what is that measuring?
Oh, it's a lot of stuff. So we've got eddy covariate flux towers. We actually work with a group called Quanterra that spawned out of Exeter University here in the UK. And we are measuring basically NPP, net primary productivity. We're measuring how CO2 is cycling through the system. So I've got a tower above ground that's measuring that. We've taken each one of these sites has 36 soil cores taken. We're measuring soil health, soil organic matter, soil carbon, others. We have above and below ground sensors for water. So we're measuring infiltration. We're measuring water cycling. We're looking at where how far down the water is pooling potentially or infiltrating. We've got those aspects. We're doing remote sensing. So this is all linked to biweekly passes of remote sensing. We're not only measuring the pretty pictures like the NDVI, but we're also measuring evapotranspiration from space with the opportunity of linking what we're measuring from the it's basically the eco stress sensor on the space station that is we're linking to our on ground ET. We've got that going. We're taking, of course, a lot of forage samples. We're doing that, but probably I'm going to say as importantly, we're also working on economics and social well-being. Well, how do we do that? We've got 20 ranches that we've identified in each of these areas.
Yeah.
20 out west, 20 down south, and out west, Wyoming, Colorado, Oklahoma, Texas, and then 20 up where we are. We didn't want to just cherry pick ranchers that we thought were regenerative or not. We want a gradient, like we want a shotgun blast of variation.
Yeah.
Everybody managing what we might deem to be super conventional all the way to whatever the cool term is, regenerative. I didn't want to use any of those terms. I just said improved ecological function to say what it meant, right? So we are also, we also have instrumented 10 of those ranches at each of those sites to the same degree our research sites are.
Right.
So now we've got it expanding, so we're getting all the same metrics, but on ranches everywhere. I ran out of money. I can spend $19 million in a hurry. But the other sites were measuring soil carbon and a lot of things, but we just don't have as much money for all the fancy equipment. So then finally, we have opportunities where we're bringing all of this data together, big data being brought together, that what we're doing is we're not only driving and trying to understand how management's influencing all these ecological indicators, but we're also marrying it to the social and the economical. Because how you define how you manage is a hell of a lot different than what you might measure,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so even defining how a producer manages, there's a lot of challenges in the vocabulary. And so we're kind of working on, and Dr. Jenny Hodbod, who's here at Leeds University, has been working on what we call this like social ecological resilience model. So it's kind of evolving down into that.
We've been going now for a while. So
we have?
We have.
10 minutes? 20 minutes?
I know. It has been just fascinating. Is there any closing comments or a little bit of advice or anything that you would like to leave our listeners with today?
Number one, I mean, I think in the UK, there is tremendous opportunity to improve these landscapes ecologically. And I think in doing that, producers will find they'll lower their costs. I don't believe you'll see a tremendous drop in productivity. The fact that you have a climate that allows you to grow grass for such an extended period of time. I did the math, and I think that I'm probably without fertilizer in 150 to 180 day grazing season, a growing 150 growing day season, right? I'm probably about 15% less in my productivity than what you guys are based on the data you sent me. But again, I'm not using in, and I have a shorter window of growth, right?
So just for our listeners, before this conversation, AHDB and myself sent over our grass check data, our forage for knowledge
data,
so that we could really show Jason what our grass grow curve looked like, what our overall field reports kind of came back at from a utilization point of view. And even through those challenging times a year of true drought and where grass growth really did drop off, we were still hitting those utilizations, but also managing and trying to prevent them overgrazing. But it is a really valuable set of data and something that we really as an industry need to take more pride in and sort of continue to build on it. Because like you said, it is a really valuable
We might need to chat more about
those measurements.
I didn't forward your data to anybody. I protect your data. Yeah, so so point being is there's a hell of a lot of opportunity in this country. I granted, now y'all have, I mean, you read about the grazing systems in the UK and it goes back, 1600s, right? I mean, it's a long time. So there's an ingrained culture. I understand that. I want to be respectful. So, but I just see so much opportunity. That's one thing. Speaking to maybe some of the hopefully younger crowd that's out there, educate yourself. Don't just go on what you learned at university. There are some great books out there. And hell, I mean, you got some people that are 80 and they keep learning, which is what I love. But there are just some great books out there to educate yourself. So that's something that's important, I think, that I want to share. Get out, go look at farms, go talk to people. This is not an academic movement. It is not a supply chain movement. It isn't an NGO movement. It should be a farmer and rancher-led movement.
Yeah.
We're all here to support. And I feel really strongly about that as well. So been great and an awesome opportunity to come out and chat.
And that's where we leave our chat with Jason Rowntree, Professor of Animal Science at Michigan State University. There's more information about our AHDB Roots to Resilience program on our website, where you'll be able to find some additional content from Jason that was recorded as part of our Module 1, Change the Goal, Change the System, Balancing Food Production and the Ecosystem. It's definitely got me thinking about what's achievable on farms, in systems, and for the industry. I'm Katie Evans, AHDB's Grass Forage and Soil Specialist. My thanks goes to Jason for joining us and to you for listening to this episode of the Food and Farming Podcast. Take care.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.